I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Offering a toast is a lost art. I'll give you some advice for how to make one without dying of embarrassment. And in the old days, a modern kitchen was found outside the home. Today, a look at just how far we've come. Also, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer Jonathan Gold is here, and he's got a restaurant to try. But first, let's check out what's in season at the legendary Santa Monica Farmers Market.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We're visiting here at the market today with Paul Shoemaker, who was the former chef de cuisine at Providence Restaurant. And Paul was now out on his own. He's coming to the market every week. And Paul, we're always interested to know what chefs are shopping for, especially when they're shopping a cookie for themselves. Have you got any great recipes you can share with us?
For me, just really simple food at home. I do enjoy cooking. Like a nice free-range chicken, a whole bird. I usually get around a 3-pound bird from the market. And I just tusk it and season it lightly, and then I usually just roast it off in a Le Creuset, like a little Dutch oven pot.
Covered or uncovered?
At first, I season it with a little bit of salt, pepper, and espalette, actually. It's a little French red chili that you can pick up probably at Whole Foods. And then I just sear it lightly in olive oil, and then I put the cover on and throw it in the oven for about 40 minutes until it's cooked. So what it does, it just concentrates all, like, the heating into that bird in that little oven and allows the bird to cook from the inside out. And then the last 15, 30 minutes, I take the cover off and then get it nice and golden brown. And then at the very, very end, I just hit it with a little bit of Dijon and some wildflower honey here at the market.
Just kind of smear it on while it's still baking?
While it's still baking, like the last 5 minutes, because you don't want to burn the honey or the mustard. Mm-hmm. So it's like once it's crispy, you just glaze it, and then you get this beautiful, amazing, crispy bird that's just glazed in honey mustard.
And you cook it whole?
Cook it whole.
And how do you brown? You brown it before you put it in the oven? How do you do that?
Well, I tusk it. I tie it with some butcher's twine. And what that does is it cooks more evenly. So if it was untusked, it would overcook your breast and you have a dry breast. This way, it just really compresses the bird to cook more evenly.
Do you fold the wings over the breast so it's kind of covered? Or are they kind of right down by the side there?
Right down by the side.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, there's a tradition. There's a couple ways to tusk a bird, but once you tusk it, you just season it and then you just kind of roast it in your pan with olive oil.
Just kind of roll it around, sear the pores of the bird to trap
the juices in, and then you know you throw it in that hot oven. I just like to get the bird kind of going, like just wake it up for cooking, and then bam, it's in the oven, and you know you're cooking.
And you cook it at what temperature?
350 is good. 375
the whole time. You don't have to reduce it. And how do you know when it's done? When it wiggles or when the juices run clear?
It tells you, or you get a timer. Yeah. It rings.
And these are birds that are obviously always fresh, not frozen.
Just some, you know, little Jidori free-range chicken or whatever, little Rocky birds.
Well, we've got them here. We've got some of our farmers have fresh chicken, and I've had it, and the flavor, for some reason, it's just better. It is. It's night and day. Yeah.
You can definitely taste the difference.
And you get the nice crispy skin, and don't be afraid to eat the skin, right?
Oh, no, that's the best part. But try it with the honey mustard. But it's got to be, like, really nice, you know, Dijon mustard and really nice honey and just a perfect balance. You just got to play with it.
Half mustard, half honey.
It depends on how you like it. If you like it sweet, more honey. If you like it spicy, more Dijon. Mm-hmm. And then you just kind of just rub it all over that bird, and it just gets that golden brown color.
Yeah, and crispy, crispy. And then maybe a vegetable on the side. Would you roast some vegetables along with?
Bloomsdale spinach. That is amazing. It's hearty. It's sweet. It's just heavenly.
You just steam that.
Some butterballs too.
Oh, the little butterball potatoes.
Those are the best.
And the butterball potatoes are here at Alex's stand. And that Bloomsdale spinach is. Now, how do you cook that? You just shake it.
And then wash it thoroughly, and then just slightly sauté a little bit of garlic oil and some garlic confit.
Garlic confit, which is what?
Which is just take a whole barrel of garlic. Break it open, but leave the skin on it, and then confit it slowly, which would be in some olive oil at a very low temp for like a couple hours. So it's just cooked thoroughly, but don't heat the oil too hot because you'll kill the olive oil flavor.
Okay, and that's on top of the stove in a little pan. Then you just add that to the
potatoes. I cook with it, or you just drizzle it over the potatoes afterwards because the olive oil is so perfumed, and then you can mash the garlic, and then you can put that on top for garnishes, and you know, it's just heavenly.
That's so good. Thanks so much for the recipe, the inspiration. And it's really clear that you like to cook.
Yeah.
That was Paul Shoemaker. And he is a former chef de cuisine at Providence. And he's, as he said, he's been on his own now for several months. And he comes to the market every week. Obviously, still very inspired by great ingredients. We're visiting with the very same farmer that Paul mentioned who grows the Bloomsdale spinach. It's Alex Weiser, and he is the potato guy. Alex, though, it's spring, and you have always constantly rotating crops. And tell us what's going to be coming up for spring.
Well, what's in for spring, Bloomsdale spinach, new potatoes. We have baby carrots coming in and beets, spring onions.
Now let's describe spring onions. Those are basically onions that are on their way to becoming full-size dry onions, but you pick them early.
Right. What we do is we plant a few rows heavily, and we transplant the small ones into the field and separate them 3 or 4 inches apart to become a mature onion in the fall. And then in the beginning, when they're straight, it's a scallion. So we're selling them as scallions. And then through the growing season, they become larger, start developing that bulb. And that's when they're called spring onions.
Okay. And now tell us, you're going to be bringing in your lilacs pretty soon.
And with spring, of course, our lilacs every year are very popular.
And those are the real mountain lilacs that really have that great smell that people like me from back east remember.
That's it.
Right.
How happy people are to see them every year.
And it's the smell. It just takes you right back to your spring. And
I think it's the nostalgia
of
it all.
It is.
The memories.
So you're going to be having those this week.
The big pile is coming on Saturday.
Okay.
At Pico and at the Arizona market.
Okay, great, great. And you'll have those for about a month or so, depending?
Again, it depends on the weather, or 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Alex Weiser. He is obviously the scion of Weiser Family Farms. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
It's time to plant tomatoes. You don't need a lot of room to get a plant that will produce like crazy by summer. And the best place to find yourself this weekend is at the blockbuster tomato seedling sale called Tomatomania. Today and tomorrow, you'll find nearly 300 different tomato seedling varieties. You'll also run into a very big group of tomato maniacs who can give you a lot of advice for your specific needs. Tomatomania takes place today and tomorrow from 9 to 5 p.m. at Tapia Brothers Farm Stand in Encino. It's just off the 101 at Havenhurst. You can take the Balboa exit to get there, too. Now, one of the best things about hosting this show is getting restaurant advice from Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer Jonathan Gold. He's here with me next to talk barbecue. That's coming up next on Good Food. When Jonathan Gold writes a column in the LA Weekly, people don't just read it, they act on it. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Weekly, and he joins me quite often to reveal his latest food finds. So, Jonathan, where are we headed today?
Koreatown.
Oh, yummy. Are we having barbecue?
We are having barbecue, as a matter of fact.
I love Korean barbecue.
The place I'm talking about today, Parks Barbecue on Vermont, is barbecue that's at least a step above the other barbecue places in town.
Why?
The meat is really, really good.
What kinds of meats are we talking about?
We're talking about basically short ribs, the galbi, which is the mainstay. They have slices of Kobe beef. They have pork belly, and they have tongue. There are other things too, but
wow, they have pork belly?
Yeah. Their pork belly is really special. They get a new hybrid that I've never actually seen anywhere else in the U.S. called Tokyo X.
And that's what the variety of animal is called?
Yeah, it's a crossbreed from Japan. They may actually get their meat from Japan that involves a lot of Berkshire and some Duroc and some other stuff that are crossbred to have a delicious fatty pig.
And is the pork belly sliced thin and marinated in something or rubbed with something?
No, not at all. You can get marinated pork belly, but it's probably better to get the unmarinated. And the interesting things about it is it comes out in half-inch slabs. I mean, these are
thick.
Thick, and they're very meaty. And you put them on the grill until it crisps up and becomes crisps on the outside and, super juicy and spurty on the inside. And you dip it into a mixture of sesame oil and salt, and you wrap it in a lettuce leaf. The quality of this, the meatiness of it, for want of a better word, the sort of porkiness of it, that pure, strong flavor is just extraordinary, I think.
What kind of heat are you cooking over? Are we cooking over gas or charcoal?
This is a hybrid. A lot of people in town are doing this now, but they use a really good quality Korean hardwood charcoal that they toss in over the gas grill. So unlike places like Sutbil Jeep that are all on charcoal, you don't come back from this meal with your nice new linen shirt looking like a colander.
Yeah, so having to immediately walk into the shower because your hair just smells like it was actually in the barbecue. And talk to me about the panchan at this place, the panchan being all those tiny little condiments that come along with the meal.
The free appetizers, as my daughter calls them. There's nothing that different from any place else, but they seem to be very fresh. Little bowls of kimchi. There's always a mound of smashed sweet potatoes,
ooh,
which doesn't seem to make sense, cold sweet mashed potatoes.
But it must be quite delicious.
It's very good. There's 10 or 12 dishes in all, and they rotate.
Now, is Park some more sort of fancy dining restaurant, or is it a casual place in terms of the way it looks?
I mean, all Korean barbecue is pretty much casual by definition, but Park's is definitely the most high-end. They use Kobe beef, for example, and everybody gets it. It's going to be more expensive than any other Korean barbecue place in town. There's a very sleek, modern look to it, and the waiters and waitresses wear tight black t-shirts. They look like club kids. There's very expensive cars in the parking lot.
And where is it on Vermont, by what intersection?
It's near 9th Street, next to my favorite 24-hour goat restaurant.
A 24-hour goat restaurant?
Any hour of the day or night. You want goat stew, barbecue goat, it's where you go.
And this is Korean barbecue goat?
It's Korean barbecue goat.
What are its hallmarks? Is it super spicy?
It can be super spicy. The best part is at the end when you finish your stew and then they mix some rice in with your leftovers and they fry it hard in the pot that the stew came in. You have goat fried rice.
But, oh, my goodness. And what is that place called?
I'm blanking on the name of it. It's the place next door to Parks.
That is so great. Is there anything else you'd like to share with us about Parks?
At Parks, somebody will always try to get you to order the seafood pancake, which is sort of a specialty of theirs. It's a big, eggy thing. It's fried really crisp at the edges. There's like a handful of bay shrimp in there, and it comes with a spicy, salty sauce that you dip it in.
Should we order it, or should we just get more pork belly?
You could always use a seafood pancake. It doesn't take up much weight.
Jonathan, thank you.
Thank you very much.
You can find Park's Barbecue at 995 Vermont Avenue at 9th in Koreatown. And you can find Jonathan Gold each week in the LA Weekly and online at kcrw.com/goodfood. We've got past recommendations and the details on Park's there too. The Kobe beef that Jonathan Gold just talked about is raised in a way that makes for incredible flavor. Before there were feedlots that fatten up cattle on corn for slaughter, there was the prairie. Cows ate grass for their whole lives, and they walked around to get those meals. Next, I'll meet a man who's trying to get cows back to the land. Tales of the Prairie and the Beef Revolution when Good Food returns on KCRW and KCRW.com. When cowboys rode the plains and pushed cattle across the prairies, all beef was grass-fed. Today, that phrase is distinctive because most of the meat we eat gets fattened up on corn in pen-like feedlots that would make any cowboy truly weep. Bill Curtis is trying to change all that. He's the founder of the Tallgrass Beef Company in Kansas. It's not easy raising grass-fed cattle, but Bill's spirit began to tingle, he says, to give this kind of cattle raising a try. When you first bought the ranch, was it a working cattle ranch?
It was. Hereford cattle, a breed that is not very popular anymore. They like to mix Angus and Herefords. It was the corn-fed model. And so I, you know, I'm now the city kid. I went back and I bought it to restore the prairie. And then I realized, oh, I have a huge debt and I've got to pay for this thing somehow. And so it was a choice between tourism and cattle. So I chose the cattle route for a little bit. Tourism, started to work on the town to give them something to see. And neither one worked.
So when did you sort of have your epiphany about saying goodbye to the corn-fed model and embracing the grass-fed model of cattle ranching?
About 5 years ago. And as an investigative reporter, I was out there reading, and I wanted something sustainable, something good for the land, and something I could be proud of. And there were all these attacks on the corn-fed model. You put them in for 6 months in these little paddocks. Can you imagine that? Coming off pastures in these little paddocks, and then you put hormones in there and you change their diet from grass to corn and you have acidosis and bloating, and then you give them antibiotics to keep them alive long enough so you can harvest them 6 months later. And I wanted to change that in some way, and lo and behold, I came across science, real data extolling the virtues of grass-fed beef. And it was rather easy. All you have to do is leave them in the pasture as they evolved on this nutrient, solar-powered fuel called grass that we can't eat. But this animal can eat it and transform it into this great protein source. And I said, that's for me.
How did you decide on a variety? Because I know that grass-fed beef has had this interesting sort of re-beginning of ranchers learning about varieties of cattle that actually lay down fat and will give us a good mouthfeel as opposed to something dry and stringy that no customer raised on corn-fed beef would want to eat.
Yes, it's true that we have kind of a bad reputation, grass-fed beef has. And one of the reasons is that we have adulterated America's herd, if you will. We harvest about 60 million head a year. We have about 90 to 100 million head in the pastures. And they're all mixed. And one of the reasons is that when you feed them corn, it forgives all the sins of raising all the different breeds. It makes no difference because you're just layering fat in with this corn. And primarily, you're tasting fat when you eat corn-fed beef. So I ran into two PhDs who had a little testing outfit, and they took an ultrasound machine around to various herds throughout the country from Wyoming down to Florida, and they're little business was to test them, and they would put the wand on a ribeye steak, a living ribeye muscle on the calf, and get a readout. And they were able to assess. They developed this software and this assessment so they could tell if it was going to be tasty and tender. And those genes exist out there among primarily the old-timers who never changed the way they did it. Everybody else went to corn, but they are still have a line-bred, pure-bred Angus breed. And those genetics go back to the original Mayflower cattle that came over.
So did you ended up getting brand-new cattle, a different variety than you'd had before?
Well, the Angus, I'd always had that, but we got the different genes in the Angus. They look the same, you know, but inside they're much different. And these will fatten quickly on grass, and they taste good on grass.
Can you describe what the chefs and other ranchers and maybe processors' reaction was like when you started tasting them on your beef?
We had our first investors who were sitting around a table, and we brought in a comparison steak from corn-fed and then the grass-fed. And you talk about a nervous moment until one of them, who incidentally has bought and sold cattle all his life at the Mercantile Exchange here in Chicago, said, well, this is the best beef I've ever had. And that was the moment, the real epiphany, when I said, this is a winner. It kind of went like a wildfire, and especially among the celebrity chefs, because they drive organic food, real food. There is this revolution, this whole movement toward a healthy food source in the United States. And they are all on these personal journeys to find something that has not been so processed, over-processed, over-salted, over-sugared. They just want the real thing. And so they found this piece of meat that all you have to do is kind of put it on the grill, put some salt and pepper on it, and, you know, it doesn't have to be used as a platform for condiments. There is an actual taste. It's robust. It's original.
Does it taste kind of wild?
No. It tastes, as I say, original. Some people describe it as nutty, sweet, the original taste of beef, like your grandmother served.
Thank you so much, Bill. This has been really a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
The Prairie Table Cookbook is Bill Curtis's recent book. He's the founder of Tall Grass Beef Company, which is devoted to grass-fed cattle ranching. I'll have a recipe and a link to Bill Curtis online at kcrw.com/goodfood. Now, to a cowboy, a modern kitchen was a fire pit out back. Today, some kitchen appliances can cost as much as a luxury car. I'll look at what got us from then to now when Good Food returns. That's next on KCRW and KCRW.com. The kitchen, throughout our lives as Americans, it's both reflected who we are as a people and, in fact, permitted us to change. With me today is Stephen Gadula. His book is The Warmest Room in the House. Were American kitchens always indoors?
No. If we go to the North American model that was the Powhatan kitchen, for instance, we had a fire outside that never went out, and it was kept all day long with a pot over top of it. It moved indoors more with the coming of the Europeans to these shores.
And once it moved to the indoors, the fire then moved indoors as well.
Well, it depends. Yes, a little of both, because we had some smokehouses with the Native Americans as well. What we saw with the merging of the two cultures was the fireplace as the center of family activity. So this was your heat source. It was also your cooking source.
So we think of that hearth with the big iron pot on a hook over it as sort of like the great room, which is funny because we're back there again, I guess.
I think that that shows that people really want to be where the food is prepared. And there's something that's very primitive about that. That's why we're back in that type of environment with the walls down and the kitchen going into the rest of the home.
But this model that we have, that's sort of the modern model with the countertops, the cabinets, trying to keep everything very clean. When did this switch happen?
If we look at the early 1900s, we have a very smoky, sweaty, hot scullery of a room. And what we see with the domestic scientist movement at the beginning of the century was the need to sort of turn the kitchen into a working laboratory, to clean it up and to make it a more welcoming environment and a less dangerous environment. By post-World War II, the 1950s, we start to see more fitted cabinetry in kitchens. We see the countertops that run over top of the bottom cabinets, and we see a more linear environment. And this, of course, makes it easier to clean things up.
And then a lot of preparation in absence of countertops would be a large kitchen table in the middle, and then you'd eat at that same table.
If you look back to some of the home magazines up to, let's say, 1925, 1930, they would periodically run contests for their readerships to help devise a more workable kitchen space. And it's interesting to see the plans that were submitted by housewives and how that kitchen table was used and how it was moved in different floor plans, basically to create what we know as the classic work triangle in the kitchen.
Talk to me a bit about this work triangle.
We have the sink, we have the stove, we have the countertop, and in some people's cases, they like to add the refrigerator. The classic kitchen triangle basically worked with the appliances and the space that were in the room at the time, and how do we use these most efficiently, and how can we move with ease from one to the other? And this is something that's actually been in play through kitchen design for years, because early in the 30s, there was the move for what was known as the effortless ballet that was going to take place. I know, I love that.
I love that.
But that was one of the things that they were calling for, that things were going to be of such easy preparation, of such easy use, that this was just going to be something that we floated through.
It's interesting to me because when I think about the paradigm of the modern kitchen with all of these countertops can be easily disinfected and made of hard materials that don't absorb, and you think back to the older kitchens, which must have been dirty and somewhat chaotic, but so much abundance came out of those kitchens.
Right, right. And in terms of the abundance, I think that the model of having the food being grown right outside the back door and being able to walk in. Also, the kitchen was used for a number of things that today we don't even consider. Most of us, at least, aren't slaughtering things in our kitchen. The kitchen itself was not as user-friendly back then, but yes, the abundance and the output was probably greater.
Because I've been in kitchens to cater, for example, I'll arrive in a kitchen which has had like $100,000 remodel, and I'll go to turn on the oven to discover that the instruction manual is still in there.
Oh, jeez. Oh, it's the trophy kitchen.
Now, there's also something that fascinates me, and that's sort of the rise of the germ-phobic sort of situation. And I guess when we saw the move away from it was when the dreaded avocado green and ochre came into our lives.
Sure, sure. And I loved talking with a professor from Kent State about this by the name of Dr. Shirley Wida. And she brought up a really good point, which was one of the reasons that we started to see this was because of the counterculture and the voice that they were having in society at the time and moving toward vegetarian foods, moving toward a more holistic approach in the kitchen and to their health. And we wanted, as she said, a kitchen that sort of reflected this hip, earthy sort of feel. So if you had the avocado refrigerator and you had the burnt orange crock pot, you were pretty cool.
So what do you think the kitchen's going to look like in 5 years when we start to slog through these economic challenges?
Probably we're going to see use of leftovers more. So I think that we're going to see kitchens that are definitely showing signs of wear and tear. But I look to what Metropolis Magazine publishes from time to time, which is their Kitchen of the Future. And I see some of the things that they've proposed, for instance, countertops where you can place a bit of flour down and it will tell you exactly how much it is. A sink that was silicone coated. So when you put your dishes in, you didn't run the risk of chipping them.
The warmest room in the house, how the kitchen became the heart of the 20th century American home, is Stephen Gadula's book. Now, for some, the kitchen can be the scariest room of the house. That's been true for KCRW Good Food producer Bob Carlson. I've been giving him some on-air cooking lessons to demonstrate how you can take some simple cooking principles and find this sweet spot amongst your pots and pans. That's coming up in 1 minute on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com.
Thank you.
Well, I've only had two cooking classes with Bob Carlson here at Good Food, but already I'm starting to look forward to them every time. Bob Carlson is the head sound engineer for KCRW, and he's been a producer of this show for 10 years. So last week, I asked you to make spaghetti carbonara. Spaghetti carbonara is that wonderful Italian dish that's sort of like bacon and eggs with pasta. Was it that easy?
It wasn't too difficult. You emailed me a recipe this time, so in a way that was almost bad.
It was like cheating.
Yeah, I was cheating a little bit, and I was slavishly following it
bad,
too carefully.
Bad.
And it actually ended up, yeah, then there were some typos, which caused me to add, you know, a cup of water when I was only supposed to add like a quarter cup of water. But apart from that, it actually went really, really well, and it was a lot of fun. But it was also a real world experience because the baby was crying, my daughter was running in and out.
First of all, did you like the finished dish?
I did. I had to doctor it a little bit at the end because I added way too much water.
So what did you do to doctor it?
I just added more of everything else.
See, I love that. So you adapted.
Right. And that's, I think, one of the strengths of doing it this way, of having you assign me these projects, because I have to do them. And if I make a mistake, you know, it's educational.
Right. And entertaining for us. We should mention that your wife, Tina, has been shooting video of you. We have the first one on the website right now. I expect that the spaghetti carbonara will be equally entertaining.
That's right. And my wife, as I was making the carbonara, my wife looked at me and said, "Man, I can't wait to make this." And of course, unstated was, "properly."
Did your daughter, Tess, enjoy that?
No, she didn't like it.
Why? Was it too weird, the texture?
No, you know, it could have been my fault, actually. She said it was too peppery.
Oh, that's interesting. So the next time you can cut back on that, maybe she'll like it
exactly,
more.
Exactly, yeah. So I have a few questions that are really basic questions that came up while I was cooking. One of them was, whenever a recipe says diced or chopped, or I pretty much just do the same thing. I just hack up the onion,
that's
regardless
fine.
Of what it is.
Diced usually means cutting it into square pieces. There really isn't that much of a difference in the finished taste of a dish as a result of how you chop it, whether it's sliced or diced or minced. The difference will be in the texture. The smaller your dice, the more these vegetables will just melt into the rest of your dish and will be less obtrusive.
The other one was, I was basically cooking the noodles from the box directions, and they suggested putting a little bit of olive oil.
No, 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 no. That's such a no-no. Do you know what brand you were using?
No, I don't, but it was actually it wasn't hard. It was the kind that was a little bit soft from the deli section.
Okay, first of all, huge mistake. Don't do that. Now I'll give you my lecture. Dried pasta and fresh pasta are not better and worse versions of each other. Dried pasta is made from hard durum wheat with no eggs. It is meant to cook al dente, so it has a lot of texture to it, so that when you pair it with sauces that have a lot of flavor, like something with bacon in it, it just pairs beautifully. Fresh pasta is made with eggs. It tends to be richer, more delicate, and it's usually paired with creamy sauces. So the next time you make this, and now you have to go back and you have to make it again, I want you to use an Italian brand of spaghetti or linguine. And I don't want you to put oil in the water, because what that does is it gets rid of the sheath of pasta that naturally clings to the pasta as you drain it. That sheath of starch, it's like a glue.
So you're saying that the sort of semi-soft pasta that's in a vacuum seal in the deli case,
dreck.
That's bad. Oh, that's interesting.
So, Bob, for your next assignment, I'm going to teach you how to make a soup that can also be a pasta. You've heard of the recipe pasta fagioli?
No.
You've never heard of pasta fagioli?
No.
Pasta fazool, a lot of Italo-Americans would call it. And all it is a bowl of usually white beans, pasta, really good olive oil, and cooked. So go to the store. If you go to Trader Joe's, they have these packages in the fresh vegetable section of what they call mirepoix. Mirepoix is just onion, celery, and carrots that are all chopped up for you and ready to use as the beginning base of a recipe. So you're going to take a pot that isn't too small, and you're going to put enough oil in it so that the oil completely covers the bottom. You're going to throw in the mirepoix and some salt. Stir it around. You're going to let it cook until it completely softens. Then you're going to take 2 cans of either garbanzo beans or white beans. Throw them in with all their liquid. And then you're going to add enough more water so it comes above the beans by 2 knuckles. You're going to add salt, a sprig of fresh rosemary, and if you happen to have in the house anything that's tomato-y, just take a couple tablespoons of that and throw it in. You can serve it like that, but then if you want, you can add a couple tablespoons full of broken up spaghetti or broken up linguine or broken up penne. Then, depending upon how much water you've started with, it'll either be soup or pasta.
Okay.
Okay, you look apprehensive.
Oh, I'm always apprehensive when you first tell me. My head is spinning.
I think you're doing really, really well.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll see you next time. I'll have the recipe from good food producer Bob Carlson's latest cooking lesson online at kcrw.com/goodfood. You've just got to watch the home movie of Bob cooking spaghetti carbonara there, too. I've got a link to lesson number 1's video. Okay, we'll see you next time. I'll have the recipe from good food producer Bob Carlson's latest cooking lesson online at kcrw.com/goodfood. You've just got to watch the home movie of Bob cooking spaghetti carbonara there, too. I've got a link to lesson number 1's video that you should also check out. If you do give these a try, write me, let me know how it's going. Email me at goodfood@kcrw.com. Some people get nervous cooking for others, but have you ever found yourself forced to give a toast to a large group of people? I've got tips that'll help you get over that stage fright. And these tips don't involve drinking. No drinking. That's coming up next on KCRW and KCRW.com. The butterflies in the stomach, the sweaty palms. You can do your best to avoid public speaking, but at some point, even the shyest of us will be called upon to give a toast. As a public speaking coach, Leandra Temescu has helped many of her clients get through these toasts. Today, she'll share with us some general guidelines for giving a toast that will be remembered for eloquence and brevity rather than awkwardness and rambling. Hello, Leandra.
Hello.
And what about the drunkenness that often accompanies these lack of eloquence and not brief things? How does one deal as a recipient of a toast that might be a little inappropriate?
One can only be gracious and smile. There's really nothing else. When you are the toastee, there's really nothing you can do but grin and bear it.
Now, what is the history of a toast?
There are a lot of stories about the origin of the word toast itself. Most of them are apocryphal. They vary from in ancient Greece, you wanted to make sure that your drink was not poisoned, so you all drank at the same time. There is the story that in ancient Rome, there were so many insects flying around that the Romans would put a piece of dry toast on top of their wine goblet, and then they would take it off to drink. The most interesting story is that the toast actually became a part of Western culture after the Eucharist. When Jesus in the Bible presented the glass of wine, that was, according to many scholars, the first toast. And so when medieval civilizations offered a toast, it was a vestigial recreation of that solemn act of Jesus in the Eucharist.
Oh, that's really, really interesting.
Yeah.
Is there a beverage that is more appropriate for drinking to commemorate the toast?
There are certain purists who say it should always be an alcoholic beverage.
Oh, I know that in some cultures, if you toast with water, it's considered to be very bad luck.
It is. The Royal Navy, if you toast with water, that means that you will end up in a watery grave.
Does every culture have a toast?
The toast, we think, started in Western culture, but it has since become a pretty universal phenomena. And there's about 50 different cultures and languages that have a specific word that is used during a toast.
Let's get to what makes a good toast. First of all, how long should it be?
I think if it is a very formal toast, such as one at a wedding, you do not want to go any longer than 5 minutes.
That's a long time, though.
It is a long time, and that's why you never want to go longer than that. But you would be astonished at the wedding toasts that go on and on and on and on and on. And 5 minutes seems an impossibly short amount of time because these people, they want to express their heart and they want to sum up the entirety of their relationship with the bride and the groom. And, you know, that's not what people are there for. In all other situations, you really don't want to go over a minute. You know, my favorite toasts are good food, good drink, let's eat. That's the best. That's the best.
Now, what's the worst thing you could possibly do in giving a toast?
Well, you alluded to one of them in the very beginning, giving a toast while you're drunk. There really is just no excuse. Being asked to offer a toast is a very solemn responsibility. It's an honor. So if you get drunk, even if you're doing it because that's the only way that you can handle the nerves, a little bit of liquid courage, so to speak, you're not going to be as good as you would have if you weren't drunk. So that would be the number one. The number two would be going on and on and on. Number three would be embarrassing whoever you're toasting. And a lot of people do this inadvertently. They want to be funny. They want to incorporate humor.
They want it to be a toast and a roast.
Exactly. And that's what we have to remember, that there is a place for that. And it's called a roast. It is not called a toast. The wedding toast is probably the most formalized toast that we've got, certainly in the United States. And it is something that you should actually spend some time preparing. Most toasts can be and should be delivered extemporaneously, purely from whatever the feeling of the moment is. But a wedding toast should be planned out. I actually encourage all my clients to script it out because this is a moment of intense emotion. And if you have something that's written out that you can refer to every once in a while, if you tend to lose your place, you're going to feel much more comfortable. But just because you're scripting it out doesn't mean that it should be stilted. This really should come from the heart. And that's the most important thing about a wedding toast.
And what subject should be completely off limits for a wedding toast?
Anything involving bodily fluids. That's a general guideline. I have yet to find things that fall outside that are inappropriate. That's pretty much what it is. There's a tendency, especially in America, to have some sort of sexual innuendo in a wedding toast. But remember, wedding guests are family affairs, and you also have older people, and they will not appreciate it.
Well, here's to you, Leandra.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Leandra Tomescu is a public speaking coach and speechwriter based in L.A., Leandra was on the show a few weeks ago talking about first-person dinners. I'll have her tips online at kcrw.com/goodfood. The vanilla that most home cooks use comes out of a little bottle. But taste and smell real vanilla beans, like the vanilla coming from Tonga, and you can see why people have lost their lives over these incredible beans. When Good Food returns, we'll talk vanilla. That's next on KCRW and kcrw.com. There is nothing quite like the smell of vanilla. We have so embraced vanilla as an aroma that we can find it now in everything. So when we hear about a new vanilla bean that enters the market as food, we're always really, really interested. With me this morning is Jennifer Sneerson. Jennifer is Vice President of Business Development for Chef's Warehouse. Hi, Jennifer.
Good morning, Evan.
Remind us what vanilla is. Where does it come from, that big, long pod?
Well, vanilla actually comes from a specific strain of orchids, the orchid flower. And the actual name vanilla dates back to the Latin word for vagina, which is what we can picture when we look at an orchid.
That's so interesting. And then there you have the vanilla bean, which could be the phallus, maybe.
<That's right. laughs>
So there, in one little flower, you have all you need.
Staying with the theme, each flower actually only produces one vanilla pod.
And is the vanilla pod a seed for the plant?
It is. It's a fruit, actually. It's the fruit of the plant. What's interesting is vanilla actually only grows within the 20-degree latitude band of the equator. It's the only area where vanilla orchids will thrive.
Are they difficult to grow? Do they have to be pollinated in a special way?
They do. They're very difficult to grow. This particular strain of orchids actually grows straight up like a vine. They tend to migrate toward 100-foot-tall coconut trees and grow straight up around the trunks of the trees. And each flower has to be pollinated by hand.
So somebody has to climb up these trees pollinating the flowers?
They do.
What a great image that is. So these beans that you're just getting in now at Chef's Warehouse come from Tonga.
These are from the Kingdom of Tonga. That's
now, where is Tonga? Let's remind ourselves.
Sure. Tonga is down by Samoa and Fiji, sort of halfway between New Zealand and Hawaii. And Tonga is actually a conglomerate of about 175 tiny islands. I believe only 100 of them are actually habitated, so it's an interesting place. Tonga is the country that receives the first daylight of the day.
Wow. So these particular beans, what variety are they?
These are of the bourbon variety.
And how are they different from other bourbon vanilla beans we may have seen?
Well, this is growing in a very natural environment. There are no fertilizers used, no pesticides. Everything is done by hand. It's all done on a family plantation. In fact, one of the owners lives here in Southern California, which is how we made this connection. So everything is really taken care of on a very personal level.
And what's the name of this company that's bringing this bean in?
They are called Royal Vanilla Beans.
Royal Vanilla Beans. When you first tasted them, tell me what your reaction was.
I think it started when I first saw them, Evan. I'm used to seeing something that maybe looks a little dried up, has something a little reminiscent of mold in the nose a little bit. These were plump and juicy and each individually perfect. And the scent was very, very pure.
Floral?
Floral. Floral's a great word, absolutely.
And then when you cut them open, because those of us who work with vanilla, I always love it. It's like this great mystery where you cut open the pod and then you scrape out the bean, those tiny, tiny little tiny seeds, which is what gives you all the flavor. Sometimes when you do that, it's almost brittle or it's a little dry. Describe what it's like when you cut these beans open.
Absolutely the opposite of dry. It's something that's very pleasant. It's a little more tender. It's moist. The aroma is released immediately. In fact, these beans are so high quality that they're not even turning them into extracts or any other byproducts right now. They're just leaving them whole in their natural state.
So that's really interesting because one would imagine that most producers of vanilla make the bulk of their money selling extract and not the bean.
Absolutely. This family farm, again, got the certification for organic. Everything is hand-picked. Everything is hand-selected. They actually dry the beans naturally in the sunlight. There are other processes to accelerate that. You can use fans and you can use, you know, certain controlled temperature rooms, but it sort of alters that natural organic state. So they're keeping everything as pure as possible.
How long does the curing process take?
It takes several months, but once these beans are dried and ready to go, from the time that they are packed in Tonga till the time that they will land in your restaurant here in Southern California is no more than 4 to 6 weeks.
Can a consumer, just a really great hobby home cook, get their hands on these?
Luckily, the Beverly Hills Cheese Store has these beans available for you.
Oh, that's really great.
You can buy them by the bean.
I can't wait to get them. How much do they cost?
The beans are very expensive compared to the regular bean. We are selling them, you know, wholesale to chefs at a couple of $100 a pound.
How many beans come in a pound?
I would say around 27 to 30.
But, you know, when a vanilla bean has that much flavor, you can really get a lot of use out of just that one bean.
Well, that's really, you know, the great thing is the yield is completely different here versus a typical dried out bean that you may get at the supermarket that's been in a glass jar for a year and a half. So whereas you may have needed two or three of those beans, you need a half of one of these beans.
Incredible. What do you like doing with vanilla?
You know, like you, I love the scent. There's something almost reminiscent of violet to me with vanilla. And so I love to even rub them in my hands and have that scent around.
Yeah, I just love, I mean, every time I cook with them, if I'm making a custard or whatever I'm doing, or panna cotta, I just love throwing that pot into sugar and making vanilla sugar.
And that sugar's great in the coffee in the morning, too.
Oh, so good. Thank you very much, Jennifer.
Thanks for having me.
Jennifer Sneerson's with the Chef's Warehouse. She's a go-to person for all kinds of intriguing and hard-to-find food items. We've all heard of anorexia and bulimia. There's a new phrase that's emerged recently. It's called drunkorexia, and it's the combination of anorexia or bulimia with alcohol abuse. Turns out there's a reason why these two things go together. I'll be right back with an expert in this field. That's coming up on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. We're all familiar with anorexia and bulimia. Well, it seems that for some, alcohol abuse is part of the mix. This is called drunkorexia and seems to be on the rise. Dr. Bunnell is the Director of Outpatient Clinical Services for the Renfrew Center in Philadelphia. It's a residential eating disorder treatment facility. Hi there, Doctor.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Describe what drunkorexia is.
Well, first off, it's important, I think, to note that this is not an official term, and it's really not used in the professional world in terms of trying to understand and treat people with eating disorders. But it describes a phenomenon or a way of eating and calculating intake that at the extreme can be part and parcel of an eating disorder, but at the margins is sort of something that a lot of young women, increasingly young men as well, are getting caught up in. And whereas most people who do this are not going to go on to develop formal eating disorders, it's pretty clear that eating this way or not eating this way and calculating food intake against alcohol intake is quite a dangerous behavior and can set some people on a path towards a formal eating disorder.
So they have this punitive image in their mind in terms of, like, let's say, a basket of what they're allowed to consume in a day. And if they know they're going to go on a binge or have a couple drinks, then they take that out of the basket. And so what's left in terms of food is more minimal.
That's sort of the fundamental premise of it all. I mean, I think you have to sort of step back and look at the overall context of where a lot of these young folks are living and thinking and breathing. And the background, the basic background is that you should not gain weight. In fact, we should all be losing weight, according to most of the media messages. So to try to balance your eating against your alcohol intake is really in the service of preventing weight gain or even furthering weight loss. Now, for some folks, not eating may enhance the drinking. You get drunk faster and get more seriously drunk if you haven't eaten. But I think in terms of what we're talking about today, the driving motivation is about guarding against weight gain.
Wow, it's incredibly sad.
Well, if I could just speak to that, I mean, I have a 21-year-old daughter and sort of have been through adolescence with her. It's absolutely normative for teenage girls and even middle school girls in our country to hate their bodies. And that, to me, has to be a cultural construction. I mean, that's something that our media and our culture has put into these girls' heads. And it's so normal now that we don't even look at it or think about it.
If we know that a lot of the reason this behavior seems to go on has maybe a root of some level of psychological pain, then it would seem almost normal to want to medicate that with alcohol or other substances. Is there a percentage known of how many people with eating disorders tend to medicate themselves?
Many people with eating disorders have what we call comorbid substance abuse problems, so that they're actually caught up in some degree of addiction as well. And if you go to any eating disorder program, residential or higher level of care program, you're probably going to find up to 20% or more of the patients have a comorbid substance abuse problem. So there's a lot of overlap. There's a sort of pain that's looking to be relieved through the behavior.
Do people who are at the more severe end of the continuum, who are serious anorexics or bulimics, sometimes use alcohol to dull the physical pain from starvation?
not so much the physical pain necessarily, although that's certainly possible. It's more likely they're using substances to help tolerate the starvation or the effects of starvation that may suppress appetite.
How do you treat these kinds of conditions where one element is telling you to abstain and then something else is telling you to consume?
Well, it's a good question. And a lot of the focus of treatment in these disorders is helping patients find a balance in their appetites. And unlike with alcohol or drugs, where you can really work towards an abstinence model and really help people not use at all, that's clearly not a solution for food or for eating. So they have to find some way to tolerate eating enough to be healthy. And on the other end, find a way to tolerate the urge to binge eat enough that they're not gaining weight or setting themselves up to feel like they have to atone for the binge by purging or overexercising.
What are the psychological and neurological links between eating disorders and substance abuse? Does it give you some sort of high?
There's actually some of the most exciting research in the field and in psychiatry in general right now is on these very issues, on the sorts of neural activity and sort of neural vulnerabilities that patients have that they bring into their lives and then need to find coping strategies for. For instance, with anorexia and the way their brains process reward and pain, and certainly that would make sense too, that they'd be using substances to sort of change that circuitry a little bit.
You know, so much of our current society seems to be about control, finding ways to exert control over your life in the face of so much chaos out there in the world. I mean, I certainly hear this in my interviews with people in terms of just different kinds of diets and different restrictions on eating. Do you see it that way?
Well, I do. I think what I'm more aware of is just that food is everywhere. Food is sort of promoted and marketed to match it up with our emotional needs, and we do that very early on with kids. At the same time, we're flooded with all these messages, and it's actually a setup for people because one of the things, the strongest associations we know in terms of eating disorder sequence is that if people are under-eating, if any of us under-eat for a period of time, our risk of binge eating goes up quite a bit.
Is there a message you'd like to stress for any of our listeners who feel they may be suffering from this disorder or a parent who might see a child seeming to be flirting with these kinds of behaviors?
There's still the perception out there, unfortunately for most people, that eating disorders are fairly minor, benign illnesses. And the thing I'd really like to stress is that these are serious medical and psychiatric illnesses with the highest mortality rate of any psychiatric diagnosis. If you know someone or you yourself are starting to struggle with these sorts of behaviors, we know you're at increased risk for ending up with an eating disorder. And the earlier we get people into treatment, the more likely we are to help them avoid a long-term outcome or bad outcome.
Dr. Douglas Bunnell is the Director of Outpatient Clinical Services for the Renfrew Center in Philadelphia, a premier residential eating disorder treatment facility. I'll have a link to the center at our site at kcrw.com/goodfood. You can find all the other info on today's show, watch the latest video cast, and also download this show and past episodes as well online at kcrw.com/goodfood. You can write me at goodfood@kcrw.com. I really love hearing from you. Good Food's executive producer is Jennifer Farrow. The show is produced by Thea Challoner with Bob Carlson, Candace Moyer, Connie Alvarez, and Holly Tarson. The music supervisor is Gary Masiha. Special thanks to Karen Soriano and Jessica Spaulding. Also thanks to Ronnie Mickelson.